welcome to the Vibrational Voyage radio program. Vibrational Voyage is about exploring the evolution of consciousness and the dynamics of global transformation. My name is Tony McGettigan, and I'll be your host for this journey. This interview with Charles Hall, author of the Millennial Hospitality series of books, was originally recorded in the fall of 2011. We start this interview with an introduction by Charles's wife, Marie.
I always enjoy being a character reference for Charles. Everyone that knows him knows he is a character, but I'm the character reference. I met Charles in 1969 when he'd been back from Vietnam a year, and we married late in 1969. A couple months after we married is when he first told me about the extraterrestrials coming into his barracks at night. I think he felt that it was wise to wait until after we were married to disclose this information. And when he told me about it, he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I really never thought about whether extraterrestrials exist or not, and I really don't care. I just hope that if I ever met one, I would behave in a manner that was a credit to the human race." And that's why later on, you know, when he was 58 and I found out about his memoirs, I gave him the title Millennial Hospitality, because our children are going to have an etiquette book for how to deal with these people from other planets. Hmm. So I think I heard the buzzword exopolitics, you know, a few years back, and I said, "Isn't that what we were trying to say when we said millennial hospitality?" But anyway, what happened is Charles had been working in his spare time for almost 20 years on his memoirs for our grandchildren, and he hadn't told me about it. Mm-hmm. I knew that he was on the computer, you know, sometime for hours after I went to bed, but I didn't really know what he'd been doing. And when he was 58, he came to the end of a contract. And, you know, when you're 58, you can apply for, have lots of nice job interviews, but not necessarily get hired. They might choose the guy who's 49 or 39. Anyway, I came into the computer room when he was a month into what would eventually be 18 months of unemployment. And he shut the computer screen real fast. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm just working on a book." And I said, "Really?" I couldn't get him to write three sentences to his mother. So the whole idea that he would write a book was mind-boggling. Anyway, I said, I need to see this. So he printed out a couple chapters. And I went into the other room and read for probably only 20 minutes. And I came back and I said, "We have to publish this." And he said, "Oh, no, I don't think so. You know, even if you don't say anything bad about somebody, they might sue you." I said, "So do what authors do all the time. Just change the names of your friends, living or dead, and pretend that it's fiction. You know, put a disclaimer in the front of the book." And he said, "Well, I don't know. The Air Force never told me I couldn't say anything about this. But on the other hand, they haven't been exactly forthcoming during the last 40 years. And I said, "So change the place names, too. You know, we can disguise them as easily as the people's names." Well, he still really wasn't interested. And finally, I just said, "Charles, you're unemployed. If the men in black come to the front door, just go with them. It's free room and board." And then he started laughing and he said, "You're right. What have we got to lose?" And I really think the fact that he was unemployed was like a gift from God, because a lot of these files, remember I said he'd been working on them for over 18 years, were on a dead but not yet buried Tandy 2000 out in our garage. So we had to coax up these old files and reformat them. And there was a lot of editing that it was involved too, not just because he's very wordy, which I actually tried not to be too drastic in my editing. In retrospect, I wish I had done more editing, but at the time I didn't want to ruin, you know, the flavor of who he is. But I did have him take out all the profanity because I said, I want sixth graders to be able to read this. It's such good stuff. And the next thing I did was take out the vernacular. You know, he'd served with guys from Brooklyn, blacks from the South, and he was trying to imitate how they spoke. And I said, these books should be able to be read all around the world. Anybody who reads English should be able to read them and not have to guess. So that was the other big editing job that I did. But anyway, we went to the we made a presentation at the UK Probe this last March in Blackpool. We were very well received there, and we're just enjoying ourselves, mostly just waiting to be sought after. We're kind of shy. Well, it's not just that. We have our priorities. God's first, and then our family. And I think that's the thing that a lot of the UFO community of interest finds amazing. They think that this is our whole world. And of course, it's not. Well, I should tell you that when he asked me to marry him, which he did right after meeting me, I mean, within 5 minutes. I understand that crazier things have happened, but it was pretty crazy for me when it happened. I demanded that he go back to school. And so even though his career was interrupted because of the service, he has a master's degree in physics and actually work after that towards a doctorate. It's just that the professor at the University of Maine in Arano wanted him to take 6 years to get his PhD, and we already had trees, and so he said, probably don't need the PhD, I need a job. Yeah. To support my family. Some of the more interesting things that happened, I think, even since we talked to you last, we finally traveled to Rome. Oh. And I left the first three books as a presentation for Benedict, the Pope Benedict. And we were I included a letter, you know, making sure that the Pope knew that although there were disclaimers in the front of the books, that everything in the books was true and happened to Charles as a young airman. Well, we had no sooner returned, I mean, a month later or so, and we got a thank you from the Secretary of the Vatican State saying that the Pope had directed him to thank us for the books, but also for the letter that accompanied the books. And I thought that was interesting because, of course, the Pope isn't required to say anything, and certainly wouldn't say anything about matters that are not, you know, that don't have to do with doctrine. And mind you, I did not give us credit at all. But the following year, when was it? It was this was in 2006, and I think it was in April of 2008. There was an article in the Lay Observatore Romano saying that it was perfectly all right to believe in extraterrestrial beings. But, of course, when we left the books for the Pope, we knew that he had more information in the Vatican Library than anyone would need. I just wanted him to have our books because I wanted to give them to him.
Yeah.
So Charles is back, and I'm going to let him talk to you from now on.
Well, thank you. It was lovely to have you give an introduction.
Well,
thanks, Marie.
Lovely to have.
Thank you, honey. Marie, I always appreciate it. But I'm ready to answer any questions that you might like.
Well, wonderful. It's a pleasure to talk with you again. Now that Marie's given us an introduction, let me just mention again that I'm talking with Charles Hall, and he's the author of a series of books called Millennial Hospitality. The whole series is called Millennial Hospitality, right?
That's correct, and there's four books in the series. I have a website, millennialhospitality.com, and you can see, which shows the books. And you can buy the books at any bookstore in America or in the world or on Amazon.com, you know, because they're distributed by the Ingram or whatever one of those big distributors are, and as well as you can buy them from my website.
I absolutely love not only your story, but the way that you express it. And it was fun to hear what Marie had to say a minute ago about, you know, the little bit of editing that she gave. But the way that you talk about your story, and your story is very, very rich, in specifically in terms of the dynamics of the relationships that you describe. And what comes across also so much in the quality of your story is the way that the experiences impact you. You're very good at recalling detail. I thoroughly enjoyed reading the books. But
thank you.
You're very welcome. It's not only the way that you give the detail, it's also the way you describe what your experience is like in the midst of these experiences. And what was amazing to me is in these days when you were having interactions with the beings that you refer to as the tall whites, and of course I'll preface this by saying there are two previous interviews that we've done. I know we've done at least two. And during those, you talked about many of the experiences you had. If I recall, it was over about 2 years that you had continuous contact, mostly.
That's correct. Yes.
Daily throughout most of the year, was it?
That's correct. From about March of 1965 until May 7th, 1967. So that's a little more than 2 years. And during that time, I spent most of that time at Indian Springs, but I also spent a month or 6 weeks up at, depending on how you count, up at Area 55, which is the gray area. The gray area is not in my books, but in the books I only talk about the tall whites and the Norwegians with 24 teeth, because I've personally seen three different kinds of aliens. Mm. And I describe, in book three, I describe the Norwegians, the ones I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth. And they look so much like us that if you weren't a dentist, you'd never notice the difference. The only way I was ever able to pick them out of the first one was pointed out to me by my dentist in the fall of 1962, before I went in the Air Force in Madison, Wisconsin. And he looked so much like, I'm going to say you and I mean, so totally humanoid, that if my dentist hadn't pointed him out to me, I would have never known it. The only way I ever got to where I could pick out the Norwegians with 24 teeth from a crowd was that the aliens, especially the ladies, were, say, like if you were at a staff meeting, and because I worked next to one for more than 6 months and never realized it until she came to me and said she'd read my book, and prior to reading the book, she didn't know who she was and thanked me and then left. The only way I ever picked them out of the crowd is that they can sit with a calm, patient expression that no human could ever match. Okay? When if you were sitting in a staff meeting, even if all the humans were sitting quietly and calm and relaxed, because we're human, we are always kind of in emotion, you know, pumping blood or something. But she could sit there so quietly and just patiently that you'd say, gee, how peaceful she is. In the TV series Globe Trekker, they have one where the guy globe tracks to northern Norway, to the land of the Samai. And he, and if you get a chance to see that as a rerun, I highly recommend it, because he is describing, when he's describing their cultures, and he has a place in there where he says, sometimes they are so peaceful, they hardly seem human. And it never occurs to him to count their teeth, because the Norwegians with 24 teeth have been coming here for a very long time, and they come from either a planet exactly like the Earth, only colder, orbiting Bernard's star, the fourth closest star at 5.5 light years, or the next star out, Wolf 579, at 6.5 light years. And it takes them, their technology is good. The tall white is the best, and the grays are in between. In 1949, one of the Norwegians with 24 teeth, I'm certain, was personally introduced to Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley. And the original goal of the space program given to Willy Ley and Wernher von Braun was to build to their level of technology. For them to make the trip from their home planet to the Earth takes them 20 years, because their spacecraft do not travel faster than the speed of light. The tall white spacecraft travel many times faster than the speed of light. The gray spacecraft do travel faster than the speed of light, but the tall white technology is better. When you see all three of them together, it's sort of like looking at, if I were to use an analogy of airplanes, the Norwegians with 24 teeth, it's kind of like looking at a DC-3. When the grays, it's kind of like looking at, say, the P-51 Mustang. And the tall whites, it's kind of like looking at the F-22, you know, or something, you know, because there's a clear level, their technology is better. There are more force fields in physical reality than what Einstein knew about. That's why Einstein's relativity, when he said it was reality, he was wrong. Reality is just a way of approaching, relativity is just a way that Einstein used for approaching the mathematics, but it's not reality. Time does not slow down when you approach the speed of light. The dimensions do not get shorter in the direction of motion. But what is reality is there are more physically real force fields like gravity and electricity and magnetism. Well, there's more. There's at least three more that I'm certain of. And in the appendix of my books, book three and book four, I have my copyrighted theory called photon theory, in which I describe these extra fields, which I've named the starshine fields. The first such field can be seen inside a beam of light. Current physics says that a beam of light is two fields, an electric field and a magnetic field. Paul photon theory says there's three, there's a third one, that a beam of light is three fields. And you can see that in my books. When the tall whites were wearing their suits, they would put out and they turned them on. It allowed them to levitate. And the suits were covered by a zone of fluorescence. And when you got up sort of close to them, like a quarter mile, when they came in or closer, you could see radioactive decay chains coming out of that fluorescence. The way it used to be possible when I was young to look at the dial of a watch with radium paint on the dials and see radioactive decay chains coming off the radium if you had a magnifying glass and you let your eyes get used to the dark. Those particles were generating more force fields than Einstein knew about. That's why they could float when the suit was turned on. But it also meant that when you looked at that suit, the light hurt your eyes, even though it wasn't very bright. When in book four, I described the night I was coming out of the Airman's Club at Indian Springs Air Base, and I was walking towards the barracks. There were still World War II barracks there, the wooden World War II style, and I was alone in the big double barracks that was down along the flight line. And there were only 10 or 12 of us on base at most. Some days there were only 4 or 5. There were many days I was the only one on base, me and the cook. And I was looking, it was a beautiful night, and I was looking up Indian Springs Valley at a group of lights, fluorescent lights. They were 18 and a half miles away from me. Now, those lights were not as bright as say, like when you looked up at the star, But when you looked at them from 18 and a half miles, they hurt my eyes to look directly at them at 18 and a half miles.
Wow.
The only way that can be true is for a photon of light to have elevated states, for a photon of light to be carrying like thousands of times more energy than what Einstein and Max Planck and those guys would have thought for. And the only way you can do that is to have a third field in the photon, because you have to have a field to carry that energy without increasing the brightness of the light or the wavelength. And as I describe in book two, the night I was out at range three, standing at my PL light stand, and I was watching a group of five of them, five adults and some children coming through, and they were in the high-speed horse formation, where you had two women in the front with their suits turned on, and then they're bent over, and then in the middle you have three kids, and their suits are turned on, so they're floating, so that all their waists are in line. I mean, so their waists are the same as their parents. And then at the back you have two men pushing. Sometimes you even have a third man pushing, but usually just two. And then that's four adults and three children. And sometimes you have a fifth guy either at the back or at the side to help turn. And then the women bend over. They all turn on their suits and raise up 9 or 10 inches off the ground. And it's like they're tobogganing when they turn on the power, because the suits are up, the power pack is on the back. And when you see them from a distance, like at a quarter mile, you would swear to God, the first time I saw one, that I was looking at a giant white radioactive horse. Because when those lights are turned on, the fields merge together and you don't see the individual people. And the first time, as I described in book two, that the horse came over, that I saw the horse coming over the ridge on the Range 4 road, and I was out there alone at 4:30 at night, I would have sworn to God that a giant white radioactive floating horse was coming down the road. And when he got to the ridge and they turned sideways, because see, the radioactive particles as they're putting out in the back give it like a fluorescent tail. And that's what the legend of Range 4 Harry was. It was the guys who saw that, who thought that there was a real horse out there. Because when you got up close, that light, that when they came through, they came up the road and they came through between where I was standing at the theodolite stand and the Range 3 lounge. And that distance wasn't much more than 50 feet. And they came through there at about 35 or 40 miles an hour, laughing like they were all riding on a toboggan. And when I looked over and watched them go by, that light was not bright enough to cast a shadow, but it blinded me for almost a half hour. You know how if you were up real close to a camera with a flash bulb and they take a picture and you're right there in the eyes, it'll take your eyes like 20 minutes or so. That's how bright that light was, that I thought for 20 minutes that I would never see again. I couldn't see anything. I've been so blinded. But the light itself was not bright enough to cast a shadow. And that's because when they turn that up, each one of those photons, it must be punching out thousands of times more energy than what Einstein or modern physicists would have ever thought for. The only way I made it back to my rudder shack was that I'd had my radio turned on and turned up loud. And I had to stumble back as a blind man would controlled by the sound of my radio. And I sat there in the weather shack. I had to do it totally blind. I sat there for more than 20, 25 minutes before I was finally starting to see a little bit of light around the edges of my eyes were recovering. And all I did for those 20 minutes was I prayed. I begged God that I would be able to get at least part of my sight back, because I couldn't even dial a phone. I couldn't even see to dial a phone to call for help.
Wow.
And after 45 minutes, when I got to where I had like a part of my vision, so that by looking to the side, I could, at least, walk to my truck. I felt like a blind person that had just been given their sight back. You can't imagine how it was a totally religious experience for me, because it was like proving to me that God heard my prayers. And I went around for 2 days with still spots before my eyes recovered. But that light, and as they went through that light, but there was never, when you looked at that light, it was never bright enough to cast a shadow. And there has to be a lot more force fields known to physics than what Einstein or Max Planck knew about. That's why their craft can travel faster than the speed of light. And one of the biggest shocks I had when I was out there is described in book 4. It was the day I was sitting there in the doorway of my weather shack at Range 3, and I was watching one of their scout craft come out of the main hangar at the north end of Indian Springs Valley. That was 45 miles up there. And after it came out of the hangar and was a short distance away, it powered up. And when it powered up, the outer coils put out a force field that protects the occupants from the forces of inertia. And when it's not, when that outer coil is not powered up, they drive it like a baby buggy because they can feel every bump. But once they power that up, they can do like 15,000 G turns and just sit there like you and I are sitting in our chair, because that force field is so uniform that they can just, and then they can do high speed motion, and they're streamlined for travel faster than the speed of light. I used to watch them sitting out in the, when I was in Indian Springs, I used to watch their spacecraft, you didn't want to be too close to the scout craft when it powered up, because that field would burn you like a microwave. But like it would be sitting out there like 3.5 miles away, and they would rise up above the sagebrush and then power up to where they would fuzz over. Once they were fuzzed over, they could travel distances like 7 miles at an average speed of 8,000 miles an hour. They could accelerate and stop so fast that if you blinked, you wouldn't actually see them move. They would just be here, and then you'd look over here and they'd be over there. And if you didn't know better, you'd think they went to another dimension, but you'd have to actually be watching to see it. You'd have to be like looking right down the line of flight to actually see them move. Because once they were powered up. Now, when you do that, if you were to try to do that with a rocket sled, the forces of acceleration and deceleration would be more than 15,000 times the force of gravity. Well, in a rocket sled, if it were made of steel and you tried to accelerate at 10,000 times the force of gravity, you would liquefy steel. And they just sat in there in the chair, no seatbelt, anything, just like you and I are sitting at our table. Once they had their scout craft or their deep spacecraft powered up like that, with buzzed over, they could do like 40 times the speed of light.
Wow.
Now, you see in my book, when I talked with the alien whom I became friends with, whose CIA name was Range 4 Harry. He was very adamant. He said the scout craft was built the same way the deep spacecraft was, which I could see, but the deep spacecraft was made many times better. And so for that reason, he himself did not like to take the scout craft faster than, say, 20 or 30% the speed of light, because it wasn't made well enough. And his reasoning was that, in his own words, that when you were traveling that fast, you were covering distance so quickly that if anything went wrong, it made it too hard for your friends to come and help you.
Okay.
Because the scout craft had to be repaired from the outside, whereas the deep space craft, like a modern ocean liner, could be repaired totally from the inside and had extra safety beacons and extra things. And so he was very adamant that the scout craft, he never wanted to take it more than 25-30% the speed of light. But even so, if you were traveling at 20% the speed of light, you could cross from here to the moon in, what, 4 seconds? See, well, when he took the American generals, and when he and the other 12 whites took the American generals, the human generals, in 1965, for tours of the backside of the moon, which I personally observed. I was never along on any of the tours, but I watched them leave from Indian Springs Valley and come back from Indian Springs Valley. When he did that, they would take typically 15 minutes or so to make the crossing from here to the moon. So they were, in terms of the speed of light, they weren't traveling very fast. You know, they were traveling like 1% or something, which is where Harry felt comfortable based on the way the scout craft was built. Remember, the Tall Whites had built it using parts that had been given them by the Americans. If you actually went aboard their scout craft and looked at the seats, you could see the mold markings from Lockheed. When you looked at the bins, you could see parts from the Airstream Trailer Corporation. You could see cargo nets. They'd obviously just gone to the generals and said, we'd like some of this and some of that. And the generals had just gone off the shelf and said, we need a big cargo net. The Tall Whites like to sleep in hammocks, and the cargo nets were perfect hammocks because they're more frail than you and I are, but they're very comfortable in the hammocks. So when you went on board, it looked like you were going into an American parts store, you know? Yeah. The deep spacecraft they built themselves, but the hull of the deep spacecraft, which I described in book 3, you know, and the night came in with the one that came in with meteor damage that I got to see close up. That was that hull was titanium, and the kind of power that the deep spacecraft had, because it was using the same type of design, a double hull, and in between those two hulls, like in the case of the scout craft, perhaps 1,000 miles of fiber optic windings.
Okay.
And then subatomic particle generators it was like an electromagnet, only not using electrons and copper, using other particles and fiber optics to generate the fields. And the deep spacecraft has had that same double hull construction, and the kind of power the deep spacecraft had, they would leave and take off on schedule, just like an airport. And when they came in, like one night I was sitting out at the Range 3 Lounge, and it was going on sundown, and I was explicitly waiting for the monthly deep spacecraft to come in and land at Dogbone Lake, which was like 40 miles northeast of me, 40, 45 miles. Usually the deep spacecraft would come in right at sundown on the night of the full moon, because that's when the Earth has it's like landing on an aircraft carrier with a smooth gravity field behind the Earth. And usually they would come in hit the atmosphere at about 12,000 miles an hour, or 8 to 12,000, and then they would come down to 10,000 feet and just stop on a dime. Because for them, this is peanuts, you know, because these speeds were so slow. Because they were making the rounds from here to the nearest star in days and weeks, you know, and even though the stars are light years away. And this night, the pilot was coming in faster than what he expected, because he might have been a new pilot landing on the Earth for the first time. And so when he got down to about 10,000 feet, he realized he was coming in faster than what he wanted. So he suddenly powered up those outer coils in order to stop on a dime. And when he did so, he made the lights in my weather shack blink and the generator go offline. And that was at 45 miles. Those fields have, there has to be a field that interacts with electricity and magnetism, but is not itself electrical or magnetic. There has to be a third field that has to be inside the photon. They have to be associated. And when you say, well, Could he have done that with a magnetic field or a plasma drive or whatever? In order to do that with a magnetic field or a plasma drive at 45 miles, he'd have had to start the sagebrush on fire out in Dogbone Valley. He'd have had to, but to take my generator offline at 45 miles and to make the lights blink, and you could feel the pulse as it came through. You had the power that the deep spacecraft was putting out, beggared description. When people, the north end of Indian Springs Valley is inside Area 51, but it is not Area 51. It is Area 53 and Area 54. It is the original Dreamland. Area 51 was never Dreamland. Area 51 is Groom Lake. Area 52 is Papoose Lake. The view of Area 51 from those mountains at the north end of Indian Springs Valley and the Papoose Lake is so beautiful that if you were to just blindfold a person and take them up there on a summer day, they would think they were on another planet. Huh. It is just so stunningly beautiful. Yeah. But Area 54 is where the hangar is. It's dug into the mountain. The mountains are all tunneled up there. Area 53 is their living area, and they live in the tunnels down underneath Area 53. And that place, and Dogbone Lake is where that was their landing field, where the deep spacecraft would come in and take off. At midnight on the night of the new moon, when the sun, the moon, and the earth are lined up, at midnight, you're looking away from the sun. So that means when you take off, you're looking once again at a smooth gravity field. So that means if anything goes wrong on takeoff, you can just power down and the earth has moved away from you and let the earth pull you back in. So it's like taking off from the side of an aircraft carrier. And they would wait until that perfect alignment happened or was close to happening based on the experience of the pilot. I used to watch them say their last goodbyes along about 11, 1130, and then for the deep spacecraft to lift off and then go out to 10,000 feet over Dogbone Lake and sit there doing the final checkdown and totally power up and fuzz over and just sit there as they were doing their final checkdown. And then when they wanted to go, when they decided it was time to launch, to take off, they would punch the button and they would just take off they'd be doing 12,000 or better miles an hour by the time they got to the top of the atmosphere. And then when they got up to space outside the atmosphere at 85 miles, they'd stop and not necessarily totally stop in space, but they'd slow down and change direction and head for the star they were going for. Arcturus was very common, and some of the stars they headed for were obviously in the southern hemisphere. But, I used to sit out there and watch them. But when they started accelerating, if you blink, you'd miss it. Wow. It would look sometimes like they were just sitting out there, and then you might turn your head away and get a drink of soda pop or something and look back, and they wouldn't even be there anymore. And now all you could see was an extra star up in the sky somewhere, and then it would be gone. Because and one time I estimated how long they would have to accelerate at the speeds they were accelerating at to reach the speed of light. It was less than 30 hours. When I mentioned that to Range 4 Harry, he was very impressed, but he said, no, we can do it a lot faster than that. He was just doing it slow. When he's here, when he's close to the Earth, he accelerates slowly. But once he gets outside the solar system, then he turns it on, So it was kind of like saying, well, that was just low gear. Where do we get into high gear, So, in terms of their ability, and my theory is that the equations of motion for traveling faster than the speed of light are the same form as the equations of motion for traveling faster than the speed of sound, only with different constants. And therefore, my theory is that there's for traveling faster than the speed of sound, there's a supersonic plateau and a hypersonic plateau. And the X-15 went to the middle of the hypersonic plateau. My theory is that their deep spacecraft those outer fields streamline it for travel faster than the speed of light, and that when they accelerate, that they're traveling on the equivalent of the hypersonic plateau only the what I call the hyperwarp plateau. My theory is that they're typically traveling at least 44 times the speed of light, but maybe faster. Remember, it's a simple matter to show that the speed of gravity must be at least 500 times faster than the speed of light. And it may be 5,000 times the speed of light. It could even be more. For example, when you look out in space using the Hubble telescope and you see two galaxies that are colliding or interacting, and then if you say, well, let me go and do that on the, let me go and make a computer sim, and you say, well, let me go and do that on the computer, because I'm a computer expert. I have a master's degree in nuclear physics, and I'm a computer expert. I have a very high classification. I still work for the government as a contractor. And if you run a computer simulation of how two galaxies would interact, remember that simulation has, in the computer model, has gravity traveling instantaneously. And when you do that, it's very easy to get the simulation to look exactly like what you see with the Hubble telescope. But if you adjust the simulation so that the speed of gravity is only as fast as the speed of light, the way two galaxies interact looks way different than what you see in reality. See, because a galaxy is big enough so that if when two galaxies start interacting, you know, and they're moving fast enough so that if gravity itself, if the force of gravity were only traveling as fast as the speed of light, that would mean that a star on one end, on the far edge, wouldn't know exactly what the shape of the galaxy was, you know, but would be responding to a gravitational field that was, you know, like 2 million years old, you know, because all the particles had moved and it hadn't been told yet. You know, when you look at a circular galaxy, especially a barred spiral, and you say, how can it be so symmetric?
Right.
See, if gravity only traveled at the speed of light, it couldn't be symmetric. And if there were only four forces, if gravity only attracted, if you only had electricity and magnetism, you couldn't have that whole big class of galaxies called barred spirals.
Huh.
Because in order to maintain the bar, gravity's got to travel a lot faster than the speed of light, and there has to be a force that compensates for gravity and repels, you see? And Einstein himself understood that there was a gap between the equations for what gravity did and the equations for what electricity and magnetism did. And when he worked in his unified field theory, he worked for 20 years trying to cover that gap without introducing another force field. He understood what would happen if he introduced another force field. Relativity, for which he was famous, would now be shown to be wrong. You see? The Michelson-Morley experiment that said that of 1896, as I described them before, that supposedly said that the basis of relativity that supposedly was explained by Einstein by saying that the dimensions got smaller in the direction of motion. He didn't have to say that at all. All he had to do was say within a photon of light, within a beam of light, there's more than two fields. See, because everyone said there's an electric field, a magnetic field. All he had to do was say there's one more field. And that was self-evident if you just looked at the experiment. But Einstein wasn't an experimenter. He was a mathematician. He didn't look at the experiment itself. No energy is lost in a interference experiment with light. No energy is gained. No color changes. That means that the electric field and the magnetic field are not interfering with each other, because if they were, you would either have to gain energy or lose energy or change the color of light. You see, the Young's two double slit experiment has been done with one photon at a time in distances too far apart. like 18 centimeters, for the wavelength of the light to reach both slits. Something else has to be reaching the other slit. That's Hall photon theory. There's a third field that I call the starshine theory field, which can take shapes. And light coming from the sun, thermal sources, is 18 centimeters wide and 30 centimeters long. But on the other hand, on a laser, it can be 2 centimeters wide and 2 miles long. The third field can take shapes, you see, but it is not itself, but it doesn't, it steers the photon, but is not absorbed. It's hardly a surprise that I would theorize that there was such a field. That's what they tell us in that in the subatomic particle zoos, that's what they tell us other things are, like the neutrinos. And when you look at the world of physics, one, say, star with a lot of mass, if it's in line with another star, does not shield its gravity. It adds to it. That means the gravity from the distant star is traveling through the matter of the star that's in front of it. And both fields are adding when you're on the other side. So why wouldn't it be true that other fields have that same property? You see? It means that there have to be a lot more properties for matter than what physicists are aware of. Hmm. And that's what you would see out when you were looking at the alien craft. As I describe it in my books, I got closer to the Scout craft and its propulsion system on the day that they suffered a coil meltdown,
right,
than any other human I know of. I was further away than 20 feet, but it was hard to judge the distances out in the desert in the bright sunlight. I estimate I was perhaps as close as 50 feet. I might not have been quite that close, but because in the bright sunlight, you know, as I describe in my books, it's sometimes a little hard to judge the distances. But they had the backs open, and they were working on the coils. Fiber optics are prone to melting down, and fiber optics are 49.6% aluminum.
Huh.
And that's a common, and the tall whites were very conscious of the temperature of the coils, because when they start melting, they lose their ability to transmit. They're being transparent particles, and it's like a transformer suddenly failing. As soon as it gets hot, then it stops doing what it's supposed to and just gets hotter and hotter, and then it melts down, right? And see, the gray technology is the same way, but not as good as the whites. And that's what the Roswell incident was in 1947. The Roswell incident was real, and there were 3 gray craft. And it was a hot day in July, July 2nd, 1947. And the grays, remembering it's the children of the grays, because the grays, the whites, and the Norwegians, they all have men, women, and children, just like we do. But it's rare to see the adult grays on the surface of this earth, because they cannot breathe our air without a breathing device. The children can, but as the children grow, their bodies grow faster than the organ heart thing makes their lungs. And so once they get to be about 17, they kind of have to start wearing a breathing device or something to help them. The adult grays, although you do see them once in a while, or I have seen a few at night, that you always saw them with a breathing device.